Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com. Good morning, Jim. It's been a while since we visited Israel and the Middle East in that part of the area. We've talked about some of the other parts recently, but they've just elected a new leader, Netanyahu, and they've had Netanyahu's been over here visiting with the president, and apparently the president's been talking to him on the phone. That picture's been all over the place. But how serious do you think the Iranian threat is to them?
Well, nobody really knows. There are two things going on here. One, the Iranian, well, of course, in case everybody doesn't know this, Iran has been run since the 1980s by a religious dictatorship. Basically, a panel of clergy has the final say on anything that goes on in the country. I mean, there's a democracy. You can elect people that the religious council approves as candidates. I mean, that's the kind of control they have. Sure, they have an elections, but you can only vote for people that the mullahs, you know, the clerics approve as, you know, proper candidates. So you basically have a religious dictatorship. Now, they've ruined the economy. They've antagonized most of the population. They know that from elections in the last 10, 15 years and even opinion polls that have been conducted and then, you know, rapidly, you know, buried. And they've used nationalism as a tool to stop the revolution. A lot of people, Iranians, are very angry. And one way to manage this is to basically distract people with a foreign threat. I mean, this is an ancient, you know, technique. What they're doing is using Israel. Israel's been basically the punching bag, the straw man, as it were, for Middle Eastern dictators for 50 years now. If you got internal problems, blame Israel. And literally they do. I mean, if you read Arabic or even Iranian, you know, Farsi language websites, and before that, people would show me newspapers and what have you, back before the web became a big deal. And you'd see these articles where they say the most outrageous things, you know, an airplane crashed in Iran, it's Israel. An earthquake, the Israelis have a new weapon. I mean, stuff they know better than to say in English, they'll say in their own language to their own people, but they know a lot of people will believe it. Because for decades, they've been preaching this hate Israel, hate Israel, hate Israel. In the past, it was in Iran, it was hate Russia, hate the West in general, hate Britain. They loved us for a while, but now we're the great Satan. In other words, distract the people with a foreign enemy and build this enemy up as the worst thing since, you know, the expulsion from the Garden of Eden, which is one of the few things Christians and Muslims agree on. They say that Israel must be destroyed, but that brings up the other point about Iran. Iran has been the big power, often the bully, in that part of the world for about 4,000 years. I mean, we're not talking about some Johnny-come-lately thing. They have been the big thing in that area for a long, long time. And they're used to getting their way. But if you look at that long, long history, which I have, you'll notice some things that happen again and again. The Iranians don't take big risks. I mean, they will conquer neighbors and they will stab allies in the back and they'll do the usual chicanery, but they're not known for being utterly outrageous in moves they will make. So if you look at their attitude towards supporting terrorism, they don't support it as aggressively as, say, Syria does. Syria's been hosting terrorists, as most Middle Eastern countries have at one time or another. They do it, A, to immunize themselves from being attacked by the terrorists. In other words, the terrorists will not crap where they eat, so to speak. So if you let the terrorists hide out in your country, they're not going to attack inside your country and blow their safe house. Iran has done that, but at the same time, they have not, as many of these host countries like Iran, Yemen, you know, they all have done it. They will not use these terrorists to make attacks for them, yeah, in a big way. In other words, the Iranians are much more cautious than most other sponsors of terrorism are. And if, again, this is simply the way they've operated, recently, last 5 years, last 10 years, last whatever. So what it comes down to is they talk a big game, but they don't walk the walk. It's all smoke and no fire. However, what they're threatening Israel with is annihilation. So, you know, the Israelis cannot afford to say, well, you know, those Iranians, they talk a big game, but they never deliver. Well, if they get nuclear weapons, they already have the ballistic missiles, they could deliver. And you've got these religious maniacs. Not all of them are maniacs, but a lot of them are. Like Ahmadinejad, you know, you hear his rhetoric. Well, there are guys worse than him in the upper echelons of the Iranian government, much worse than him. I mean, guys, they sort of have to keep in a cage, you know, don't let him out. You know, they shuffle him off to minor jobs so they can't get into trouble. But some of these people who go beyond Ahmadinejad are running like Al-Quds, which is the government department, which is dedicated to basically stirring up terrorism, fostering, Islamic terrorism in foreign countries. Now, these guys, for example, were in Iraq for a couple of years. That's where the shaped charge, you know, roadside, you know, bomb came from, straight out of the Iranian factories. They are now pulled back into Iran. In other words, the mad dogs are allowed out to cause a certain amount of damage, but when the majority of the religious leadership decides that, it's a little too much, you know, the Americans might bomb, they might invade, they will get together and pull these guys back. Now, that causes a lot of internal yelling and screaming and what have you. But they do have a certain amount of power. They can burn political capital, so to speak, to handle these guys to a certain extent. What the Israelis are afraid of, if there are the missiles and there are nuclear weapons, and it is possible for a bunch of these mad dogs to get enough control, enough power inside Iran to launch a missile. Now, it's a totally ridiculous thing to do. I mean, Hillary Clinton, of all people, has told the Iranians point blank, there will be retaliation if you pop a nuke on Israel. I'm not, and she wasn't talking about the Israelis firing back, which they undoubtedly would. But, you know, there'd be some American nukes in there as well. So this makes it clear to the Israelis, the Iranians, especially the ones who are nominally the adult supervision, that we cannot go all the way. But the Israelis are talking about national survival. I mean, one nuke could wipe out at least, maybe a third of the Israeli, you know, the Jewish population. And the Holocaust, I mean, this brings up all sorts of bad memories, shall we say, to put it mildly. And so they have to make operations to deal with that. And so that's their attitude towards Iran. It's not the same as the rest of the world. The rest of the world can afford the luxury of saying, oh, why don't you talk to those nice Iranians?
Right.
They can't do that.
Well, now, one of the things that the Israelis have been dealing on and off with is the Lebanese border. Is that pretty stable right now, or are they being attacked over the border at this point?
It's very stable. I mean, there are two things going on there. One, you do have the UN peacekeepers, who are totally useless in some respects, but apparently there have been off-the-books diplomatic negotiations between Europeans, the Iranians, and us. And the upshot of all this was, let's not have anything unpleasant happening along the Israeli-Lebanese border. We don't need this crap. Again, the Iranians can pull their mad dogs in. Hezbollah has other problems, and this became very obvious just last week when they had national elections, and Hezbollah thought they were going to triumph and get a majority, and they lost ground. Now, in hindsight, that shouldn't be surprising, because Hezbollah has been acting like a bully, They forced the majority to pass a law which basically gave Hezbollah a veto over anything that the Lebanese government does. Everybody knows that Hezbollah has both Syria, who Syria unofficially and believes that Lebanon should not exist. I mean, Lebanon used to be, before the end of the Ottoman Empire, simply the coastal portion of Syria. And the French came in after World War One. They decided, gee, we got all these Christians, the largest concentration of Arab Christians in the Middle East, in Lebanon. Wouldn't it be nice to give them their own country? And basically, at that time, they set up Lebanon where the Christians were a majority. Unfortunately, the Christians weren't making babies as fast as the Muslims were, and now it's now about maybe 60%, you know, Muslim, only 40% Christian. But it's still the country in the Middle East with the largest, you know, Christian, you know, population. But the Syrians still consider it, you know, basically a crime what the French did. French don't care. They never do. They still should own all of the Lebanon. Now, the Lebanese, both of all faiths, do not want to be run by Syria again. They like the idea of being, I mean, in ancient times, there were periods when Lebanon was Lebanon and not part of Syria. So the Lebanese and the Syrians basically have a difference of opinion on who should belong to what. But the Syrians have Iran as an ally. Iran is subsidizing, funding, paying for, arming this Hezbollah, the Shia militia. The Shia are about 40% of the population. Most of the Muslims in Lebanon are Shia and always have been for a long time. They were always the poorest part of the population. They weren't as educated, weren't as economically successful. And they have the most grievances. Obviously, there's all those big shot Sunnis and all those damn Christians looking down on us all these years. We'll show you. You know, the usual routine. So it's a bit of a mess up there. The Lebanese obviously have a problem. And the Israelis have a problem. And of course, Iran has a problem in that they would lose a lot if the Israelis and the non-Shia Lebanese decided to get together and stomp out Hezbollah. Now, that's something that you don't read about in the news, but it's something you hear about. Our correspondents over in that part of the world, including at least one in Lebanon, when I ask them, what are they saying on the street? And for several weeks now, I've been hearing, you know, a lot of people, non-Shia, obviously. And he did say, he's even heard from a couple of Shia, we should do something about Hezbollah. You know, these people are nothing but trouble. So it's just like what happened in Iraq, where, you know, we reported that a lot of Shia and Kurds were saying, why don't we just throw all those Sunnis out? They're nothing but trouble. Again, you know, newspapers don't like the media. Mass media doesn't like to report that, although their reporters, I know people have told me, they're the stringers they send out to do all the reporting, you know, in places like Iraq, come back and say, you know, people don't like the Sunnis very much. But they don't like to report that because it's, because it's encouraging, you know, ethnic cleansing or genocide or something like that. Look, it's what people are saying. It's what they're thinking. So you have a bomb ready to go off, several bombs ready to go off in Lebanon. The Hezbollah, even though they declared victory from the during the 2006 war, most people up there, including a lot of Shia, don't consider it a victory. And to scare the Hezbollah even more, when the Israeli went into Gaza last December for that 22-day war, the Hezbollah was basically appalled at how successful the Israelis were at defeating the Palestinians, who were basically playing by the Hezbollah playbook. So now the Hezbollah is back to the drawing board. Oops, we've got to come up with some new tactics. But the Israelis are way ahead of them. I mean, you know, there's nothing more instructive than defeat. Right. And even though technically the Israelis didn't lose in 2006, they didn't win like they were accustomed to. So they've changed their tactics and they've scared the crap out of Hezbollah. So basically, that's why everything's quiet up in Lebanon. Everybody's trying to figure out, you know, what should I do next, and they're not sure. So all this uncertainty. So that's why it all comes back to Israel and the Palestinians, and that's what Netanyahu and Obama are talking about all the time on the telephone.
Right, and the problem in Lebanon that it was seen as a failure, if not a defeat, was the casualty rates, right?
Well, the Israelis lost very few people, as they usually do. What the Israelis failed to do was stop the rockets. And the Lebanese, the Hezbollah, had basically worked up a set of tactics which, you know, again, playing on the enemy's strengths, you know, so they're no longer strengths and they become weaknesses. And they basically figured out a way to keep the rockets coming no matter what the Israelis did. Of course, what the Israelis were going to do was go to Damascus. You know, they weren't headed for Beirut. They knew who the enemy was. And that's why all of a sudden, you know, Hezbollah decided, yeah, let's make peace. Because they got a message from Damascus, hey, look, you know, we know where the Israeli army is heading.
Right.
You know, and we don't want them here. So do whatever you have to do, shut the hell up, and, you know, make peace. And the Israelis told the, you know, Syrians as if they needed a reminder. He says, look, if this happens again, we're not just going to bomb southern, you know, the Shia, the Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. We're going to, you know, do a little urban, you know, modification in downtown Damascus.
Right.
So be known, you know, what the cost of another, you know, 2006 operation is going to be. So Lebanon is basically out of the picture for the moment.
Right.
The Iranians ideally would like something to happen, but the Iranians are spending more time down in Gaza, where they think they can basically get Hamas to do another, you know, 2006. Of course, they found out a few earlier this year that it's not that easy.
Right.
So, you know, things are a little quiet down there. So what Obama and Netanyahu are trying to sort out is, well, where shall we go with this whole peace with the Palestinians thing?
Well, and it looks like the big contention is going to be the West Bank, as the Israelis don't seem to want to do the same thing that they did in Gaza with the West Bank now, although that's where it was headed at one point.
Well, some Israelis do. It's, the Israelis basically have come to a decision point, a very important one. The vast majority of Israelis, not all of them, but like say 80%, have agreed that you got to wall off the West Bank. We cannot have any, you know, thing to do with them at all. I mean, the terror bombing campaign that started in 2000 basically destroyed the peace bloc in Israel, in the Jewish community. There were a lot of Israelis who were willing to do a lot, like, you know, pull out of Gaza, in order to make peace, long-term peace with the Palestinians. But the, you know, when they offered that deal to the Palestinians in 2000, and the response was not just a no, but a terror campaign inside Israel, mainly aimed at civilians. That just killed it. And so that basically made it possible for the Israelis to, and then they're almost done with it, you know, build a security wall like the one they have around Gaza, which the Palestinians have never penetrated. I mean, a few people have got, you know, a couple hundred meters outside of it, but basically it's been impenetrable. And not for want of trying. They keep trying, and they keep failing. They're building that same sort of wall around the West Bank. That's where they want to leave it. The point of dispute right now with the Palestinians is exactly where is the wall going to run, because the Israelis have been building all these settlements. They have a quarter of a million Jews living inside of the West Bank. But that's because the Israelis, like the Palestinians, have their radicals. There are a lot of Israelis, maybe, 25% of the population, who believe that, you know, Israel should be all of ancient Israel, which includes most of the West Bank. And, of course, the Palestinians are saying, well, where are we going to go? Well, a small percentage of that 25% of the Israelis saying, well, you should go somewhere else. Hey, look, we wandered in the desert for 40 years. Why don't you try? You know, it might do you some good. I mean, they don't care. There are, I mean, the radical, you know, Israelis are saying, let's just case them all into Gaza or into Jordan. I mean, that's totally impractical, and a lot of them realize it, but it makes for great rhetoric. You know, what are we going to do with the Arabs? You know, drive them out, you know. But they can't do that. But at the same time, these people have enough political power where no Israeli, you can't form an Israeli government that ignores these, you know, the radicals.
Right.
Who basically support the settlements. And so Israel, as a democracy, cannot get rid of the settlements. Now, that's a real problem. you know, and Benjamin, Netanyahu tells Obama, he says, look, pal, you're a Democrat. You know, we're both we're heads of democracies. Let me explain the facts of life. Now, Obama's a very bright guy, and he understands that stuff, which apparently accounts for his change in rhetoric, you know, over the last, you know, month or so. And he understands that, rock in a hard place. Irresistible force meeting the immovable object. How the hell are we going to get around this? And he's basically where the Israelis were in 2000, 9 years ago, when they basically got together with the Palestinians, the ones who were reasonable, and said, look, this is the best we can do. And Arafat basically sided with his own radicals, said, well, let's go bomb the bastards. If they won't give us everything we want, then we'll just blow it all up. That's basically what they've done.
Right.
Now they're trying to put Humpty back together again, and they're having a hard time because the radicals are running Gaza.
Right. And that's what the Israelis don't want to repeat in the West Bank, right, is the secret.
Oh, they will not do that. No way. I mean, every time a rocket comes flying, they have several to a week out of Gaza, you know, and even if it lands in the desert, it reminds the Israelis of what's going to happen if they basically just walk out of the West Bank.
And they've got a bigger problem with the West Bank because of its border with a Arab country and that being porous and
it's not that porous.
Okay.
The Jordanians have been friends, shall we say, or frenemies, whatever you want to call it, with the Israelis for a long time. You know, the Hashemite kings are very, very savvy guys. And the current king is basically taking after daddy. He's saying, look, I got to say certain things, but when push comes to shove, I got your back. You've got mine, right? And the Israelis have been very good about that. And the Jordanians have basically, that border is pretty tight. But the king is one bullet away from the Israelis are always one bullet away from losing that kind of support because it is a widespread support in Jordan. The majority of Jordanians support the Palestinians.
Right.
It's the Bedouin minority, which the king basically relies on for his personal security and maintaining control over the country that keeps him going. So the Israelis, you're right, in the long term, they can't depend upon a secure border, you know, with Jordan. But the other problem is, you know, the only thing rockets can reach from Gaza is mostly desert. There's only a few towns, you know, within range of even their longest range rockets. But with the West Bank, my God, you've got most of the Jewish population within range of short range rockets coming out of the West Bank.
Yeah.
And this is what, you know, Netanyahu is explaining to Obama. He says, how are you going to protect us? We can protect ourselves, but this is what we have to do. And you're telling us we can't do it.
Right.
So, you know, where's your solution?
And as usual, there probably is no good solution here, but to continue to try to ride the tiger, right?
That's basically it. I mean, the Arabs have caused their own problem. They invented the problem in 1948 when they basically told the Palestinians, flee or, hey, don't worry, whatever happens, we'll come and save you and drive the Israelis out. Well, that's gotten old. Not just 60 years old, but it's basically proved to most Arabs that it's never going to happen. But it's difficult to turn around a policy that has been pursued so energetically for 60 years. And that's what they're basically up against. Now, most of the Arab countries have essentially walked away from the Palestinians. Some have been more vocal about it than others, but that's basically what's happening. The primary support of the Palestinians right now is Iran, which infuriates the rest of the Arab world because they're basically having an undeclared war with Iran. Something you don't read that much about in the Western press, but boy, you talk to anybody over there, whether they're Iranian or, and the Iranians basically don't take it seriously. I mean, they consider the Arabs a bunch of, you know, sandbillies, whatever you want to call it. They don't speak too highly of Arabs. And they look at the Arab fear of Iran as, so what? You should be afraid of us. I mean, they take that for granted. And that just infuriates the Arabs even more. They don't get no respect from Iran.
Right.
In fact, what a lot of Arabs say, you know, and I've had Arabs tell me this to my face, is, look, we get more respect from the West than we do from Iran. and more protection and more security as well. So everything has been turned upside down in the last 10 years over there. And now, of course, they have Iraq to worry about because you have an Iraq democracy, which is basically run by a Shia majority, which, although it's Shia like most Iranians are Shia, it's Shia Arabs who don't like Iran either. Most of them. They say religion be damned. We're Arabs and you're not. And, you know, we don't trust you. So, you know, there are no easy solutions in the Middle East. And of course, the problem with the Palestinians is nobody, where they're farther away from a solution than ever. And the thing with the Gaza basically keeps them separated. There's not even one Palestinian government entity you can talk to make a peace deal.
Right.
Fatah's willing to make one kind of peace deal. Hezbollah is basically going to give you a truce until we get strong enough to kill you. That's what the Israelis are looking at. And of course, if you look at the, at Fatah, Fatah is not that much different from Hamas. They differ only in tactics. Fatah has been pushing the same internal propaganda line as Hamas has been doing, but they haven't been doing it in English. They've been basically saying, you can do this to yourself. You can go look at it. You can go mess around, look for Fatah, PLO websites in Arabic. Actually, even in English, you'll find a lot of this stuff now. And you'll notice all the maps of that part of the world, they don't show Israel.
Right.
As far as they're concerned, Israel has no right to exist. They shouldn't even be on the maps. But if you read some of the Arab rhetoric, they're talking the same kind of talk. They're talking Ahmadinejad talk. Israel must be wiped off. Israelis must be killed. Jews must be killed. Jews are evil. That's what they're saying to each other. How can you expect to work out a deal if that's what they think?
Right. I think we ran a pictorial like that in our photo gallery a couple of years ago. Yeah. The other scary thing was the pictorial we ran that had them all doing the Nazi salute.
Well, that's Hamas. Well, and that's another dirty little secret in the Arab world. They did during World War II, and they still today, they respect the Nazis, not just as people who kill lots of Jews, but because they're national socialists.
Right.
That appeals to a lot of Arabs, nationalism and socialism. And that's what the Nazis were. I mean, we tend to talk about, you know, fascists and what have you. No. They were more complex. I mean, fascism, what is fascism? You know, you ask most people and say, well, I don't know, bad guys. Well, no. Hitler had a very specific, as did many other Europeans at that time, a very specific political program. And it was based upon nationalism. In other words, our country, uber all, you know, the greatest of all, will do anything to defend it, expand it, et cetera. Well, that's nothing new. And socialism, which means we're going to spread the wealth around. We're going to soak the rich as much as we can, and we're going to make everybody, you know, chicken in every pot. And that still resonates today, and it's basically resonating in the Middle East. And that's why you hear people, you know, using the term Islamofascism. That's basically what it is. It's national socialism. The Arabs tried to unite. They still talk about uniting, you know, the great caliphate, you know, the united Arab, world. Well, that fell apart 1,000 years ago, and it ain't coming back. I mean, they tried seriously in the 60s, you know, after World War II, and it didn't work at all, despite some energetic attempts. So they have internal problems they have to work out. This whole, you know, allegiance to fascism is not a good idea because it's again, one of the failed isms of the 20th century.
Right.
And they're basically searching for another one. I mean, Islamicism isn't working out so well either. And now you have the democracy experiment in Iraq. And a lot of Arabs are looking at that very carefully. I mean, as things quiet down there are a lot of people coming into Iraq as basically political tourists. And just talking to people, saying, how's it working out? Which makes a lot of the people, you know, dictators running most Arab countries nervous.
And
because they have everything to lose if democracy in Iraq succeeds.
Especially since, you know, part of the democracy is capitalism, and there is this long historic streak of the Arab merchant.
And for a long time, there's been a struggle between the government and the merchant class. And what the merchant class would dearly like is what happened in the West, where the merchant class got the power they thought they deserved. I mean, that's why the kings ruled in Europe,
right.
Or in Britain, they basically worked out a deal. But basically, that's what democracy basically is, not just people voting, but money voting.
Right.
And the merchants would like nothing better than to vote their assets.
Yeah.
And if that happens, you know, bingo, here goes, you know, that's what's happening in China, in slow motion. And that's the way of the world. If you want to see what the future is going to be, just look at the past.
Right. Well, Israel's and the Arabs are going to give us a lot to write about on strategy page for years to come, I'm sure.
That's true. With peace breaking out in so many other places, we need the Arabs now more than ever.
Right. All right, Jim. We'll talk to you next time.
All right.
Good week. Bye.